I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Do you remember that 70s show, the one that jump-started the careers of actors like Ashton Kutcher and Mila Kunis? Well, there were some veterans in that cast. Today we're joined by stage and screen actress Deborah Jo Rupp. She played the lovable mom, Kitty, in the hit sitcom. We'll learn about her extensive career in showbiz, as well as her latest gig happening in Overland Park. Then there's a little something happening this Sunday. For those wagering on the big game, we'll review the teams and explain how the odds and the point spread can work for and against you. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Legendary TV moms? Well, there's been a few. Carol Brady from The Brady Bunch, June Cleaver from Leave It to Beaver, and Samantha Stevens from Bewitched, and that's only a start. Here's another, Deborah Jo Rupp, or Kitty, that quirky mom from That 70s Show, who, for the record, has done a whole lot more than that during her long run in showbiz. A few years ago, Deborah Jo was nominated for an Outer Critics Circle and Drama Desk Awards for her one-woman performance in Becoming Dr. Ruth. These days, she's in Kansas City to appear at the new theater restaurant production of Boeing Boeing that opens February 15th. Deborah Jo Rupp just happens to be right here, right now, and welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, there are all these legendary TV moms, as I just said, Deborah, and in 1998, you became a TV mom yourself on That 70s Show. What did you want to add to the notion of TV mom?
When I did the role?
When you did the role, sure.
Well, I was a little, I don't know what was the matter with me, but I turned the role down three times. Because I had, I was waiting to hear about two other series. And I thought one of them, I was sure one of them would go. And I really wanted to do that. And originally, 70s Show was called The Kids Are All Right. And I thought, well, I don't want to do a show about the kids.
Yeah.
So I turned it down three times, and then
they kept coming back, though, it sounds like.
They kept coming back. And see, the way to get me is my agent called and said, Deb, come on. They're really requesting you. And I got all flattered. And I went, oh, okay. Well, let me go in then. I'll just go in. But I didn't know it was called The Kids Are All Right. I didn't know it was the 70s.
Yeah.
Until I walked on set the first day and I saw all the avocado appliances. And I went, oh, my God. And they went, oh, yeah, it's 70s, Deb, 70s. Because then I really would have turned it down because I don't look good in those clothes. I didn't then. It was bad, very bad.
The shows you were looking at, can you say what they were? Were they some shows that really took off?
No, they didn't go.
Oh, so
no.
Okay.
See, had they gone, I would have had to do those.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? I was in third position for a 70s show. First position, if that goes, you are contracted to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Then their second position, that one actually did go. It was a drama. Jason Begay was in it, and Moira Kelly. But I was a very peripheral character in that, so I just did the pilot, and then they let me do the 70s show.
Well, why do they want you so bad, the producers, for that 70s show?
I think it's because I had appeared on pretty much every sitcom
in America
known to mankind in the 90s, and this was 1998. So a lot of people knew who I was, and I had worked for Carsey Warner several times. So I just came to mind.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you do a show like that and it begins to sort of take off, do you even think about these legendary TV moms like June Cleaver? Or is that just like completely the last thing on your mind? You're just trying to do
what you do. Oh, no, I didn't think about it at all.
Yeah.
No.
Because that really is sort of part of our culture, these TV moms who
I know you kind of grow up with them.
Yeah.
But I didn't really because because I was never into the family shows apparently growing
really?
Up.
Really?
No, I didn't really. Maybe the Partridge Family. I'm like, I knew Shirley Jones and, but not to me. No. You know what? That's a lie. Happy Days, Marion Ross. I didn't grow up with her, but she was the TV mom that I most remembered.
But a lot of folks grew up with you now.
I know,
including
and I can always
my 18-year-old son. He just is a huge fan.
Well, I have my people.
Yeah. And did you feel like, is there a responsibility that people like that, or is it you're just doing your role?
I'm just doing my role.
Yeah.
I just, I loved doing her, and the writers wrote to my strength. So apparently I am very good with passive aggressive. Who knew? But I love it because you can't do it in real life, really.
Oh, can, though. We all do it, don't we?
Well, I try very hard not to do it, Stephen.
Yeah. But
I was allowed. I could just be out there with it. So I got a lot of aggression out with Kitty.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful, too, that she was a nice person because I can't imagine what it's like being in the grocery store if you played like a mean person. Because people get a big smile on their face when they see me, you know?
Which
it has
is
nothing to do with me. It's just
sure
all
it does,
Kitty. No, I think it's really, they don't know me. It's Kitty. So I'm very grateful for that.
Do you really separate the two, yourself versus the role you played? I mean, in your mind, complete separation of.
Oh, I'm not nearly as nice as Kitty
really?
In real life. No, I have a very dry sense of humor. I think that I would have dealt with Red. Well, no, she was pretty smart with Red, actually. I'm a little drier and possibly not as kind.
Well, let's listen to a scene from that 70s show, and this is Deborah Jo Rupp as Kitty showing off her not-so-nice side, getting awfully mad here, okay?
This place has a washer and dryer.
Wait, a washer and free water? Oh my God, it's like there's no reason to ever come home.
Washer and dryer, Red. They are going to have a washer and dryer. That redheaded harlot is going to be shouting out my baby's grass stains. What about my last summer with my youngest child? I bet you weren't thinking about that when you went fishing. I bought sparklers for the 4th of July. He loved sparklers, and now he's leaving, and what are we going to do for the 4th of July?
There's a car show in Kenosha.
A car show? I don't want to go to a car show in Kenosha. I want three more months with my baby boy. And now they're gone because of your bull. Way to go, dumbass.
You remember that scene?
I take it back. I'm very much like Kitty.
Completely, right? Yeah. The laugh track in that clip we just heard is pretty noticeable. Yeah,
but
here's
the thing.
Yeah,
that is not a laugh track.
What is it?
That was our audience.
Really?
Yeah, you shoot it in front of a live audience.
Is it come and flow like that, like this naturally, or?
Well, the show is.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you got to clear your throat.
Okay, the show is filmed in front of a live audience,
okay.
But it's also edited. Okay,
sure.
So the laughs are really there. They're not adding laughs. They're not putting laughs in because it's all recorded at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason that it comes and goes like that is because they take different takes from different takes, different, you know what I mean? So it's the honest laugh to that performance. And I know a lot of people think that it isn't because it's so loud, but that's what our audiences were like. They were nuts.
Huh. And is it difficult to play with that and to continue acting when people are still laughing?
Oh, no, it's my favorite thing
really?
In the world. Yeah, it's my favorite thing. It's a little different. Theater and television is a little bit different because in television, you don't say your next line until the laugh has completely died down so they can edit.
Right.
But in theater, you say your next line when the laugh peaks. So it's a different kind of a timing between the two
But people
things.
Can't hear you if the laughter is peaking in the theater, can they?
Yeah, because they quiet down really fast.
Oh.
And that's what you want them to do. You want to control the pace.
Mm-hmm. But on TV, you got to wait a while.
You have to
pause,
wait.
You,
because it's
freeze.
For the editor. Mm-hmm. It's for the editor. They say that film is the director's medium, television is the writer's medium, and theater is the actor's medium. Because
huh.
the actor gets to kind of control the pace of
yeah.
the show.
Kitty's laugh, you know, was that a spontaneous creation or did you have to give it some thought?
No, it was completely by accident. It was incredibly stupid in the pilot. And actually, I think this line got cut. I think it got cut. And it was, you know, we're having that big party. It's the very first episode, big party. And I, at one point, I go over and I say, well, I think I'm feeling like a little Tom Jones. And as soon as I did that, the audience went nuts. And from that point on, I was stuck with that laugh. For 8 years, I had to do that laugh.
Was it hard for you?
No, because it comes from a certain place inside me. It was actually hard to get rid of because it became my laugh for a while. And my friends would look at me and go, you can't, you have to stop. Stop that.
That's just obnoxious.
Yeah.
We don't
yeah.
like that. Do you sort of end up sort of aspects of your character meld into your private life? Like sometimes I think, you know, I've been a journalist for 36 years and that's just what you become and you can't get away from it. That's just who you are.
You mean the character?
Yeah, the character in your
no.
case. Yeah.
No, because she had a really high voice. She had the hair, which, mm-hmm. no. And no. she was a lot like my mother, mm-hmm. Kitty. I made Kitty a lot. You know, my mother was a little emotional. And very kind of miss, passive aggressive. And so because she was my mother, she was not me. So mm-hmm. no, it didn't. The laugh was hard.
Yeah.
That was difficult. But
so how much of Kitty was sort of handed to you by the writers and how much did Deborah Jo Ruff sort of bring to that role for based on your own life?
I don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know.
Yeah.
I know that I didn't have to. You can tell if a part is meant to be for you if it's easy to learn the lines or not. If it's hard to learn the lines, it's because you don't understand the character yeah. and you don't get what's going on. And
was it easy for you?
It was really easy.
Huh.
It was really easy.
Yeah.
yeah. So is Boeing, by the way. That's coming very easily to me, too.
Which has got to be, we'll talk about it. But
yeah, no, I know.
You play a housekeeper in that. And
I know, but the part is, that's coming more easily than I thought it would.
This is the role she plays at the new theater
yeah,
restaurant
yeah.
coming up here. Opens up on February 15th. So
I yeah. wasn't trying to make an extra plug. I just thought that I would add that in.
It's okay.
And our publicist sitting right here is so happy that
yeah,
I did that.
That's right. Well, that 70s show had a cast, obviously, of these young actors that have mm-hmm. since gone on to recognition mm-hmm. and other projects as well. And you're smiling as I even bring this up. Mila Kunis, Ashton Kutcher, Topher Grace. Did you have a sense then of the promise they showed as actors that they were going to take off?
I thought the show would get canceled in 1 year. I am the worst. Oh, I am the worst. I can't predict anything. I don't. Yes, I absolutely did. I didn't even think it was that funny. I just didn't think it was that funny.
Really?
No. I was shocked. And we had...
Why didn't you think it was funny? What was it about the humor that wasn't...
I don't know. It just seemed stupid to me.
Really?
It did.
Did it seem stupid when you began to get into it? Or did it ever grow on you?
It did grow on me.
Well, that's good.
We also had a big whammy against us because we were on Fox. And in our first 3 years of Fox, we had three different presidents of Fox.
Oh.
And it's the same old thing, you know, politics. They want to do their own thing. They want their own product. So we were sure every time a new president came in that we would get canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And I even had a friend that was kind of high up in Fox because he would let me know what was going on. And he would say, well, I don't know, president, whatever, sat there and said, well, I don't get it. Why is this show getting good ratings? And that was our show.
Huh.
I mean, I happen to agree with him. But And then we just grew in popularity. You know, I was astonished. And then I was really happy. But I think the first couple of years, you're finding who you are. And I think that's when the writers start to go, oh, I get it. And they start writing to people's strengths, like mm-hmm. Ashton and his physical comedy, you know, Danny and his dryness, Topher just naturally gifted, you know, comic. And I think they just start to write to it, and then everything like gloms together, and then it's really fun.
Did you feel the show clicking with the audience at some point as you ran through it, you know, halfway through the first year or halfway through the second?
Here's the thing. What happens is the audience gets to know the characters. So you can just stand there and do nothing, and the audience is screaming, laughing, because they know you so well.
They know what you're going to say.
So it was really... It got to be so much fun. It got to be so much fun.
Oh, that's great.
And I'm doing, actually, Danny and Ashton have a series called The Ranch on Netflix, and I'm doing that now with them as a completely different character.
Because you read the cast remains close even today. At least that's what's on the internet. Who knows? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They support each other and all that stuff.
I just saw Mila and Ashton, and you know, their new baby. They have two babies now.
Yeah, they're married. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's just insane. Mm-hmm. It's insane.
What's insane?
That Ashton was Mila's first kiss ever in her life, ever.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. And today they're married with kids.
I know.
There you go.
I know.
Okay. Let's do this. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll continue our good conversation here with Deborah Jo Rupp. She stars in Boeing at the New Theater Restaurant. It opens February 15th. More information and tickets, newtheater.com. We'll talk about Deborah Jo's background in theater and rise to fame and all those kind of good things. And later on this hour, we'll talk Super Bowl with Joe Posnanski. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Well, yesterday, the ethics professors discussed the moral standards of protesting and how Democrats should respond to the Supreme Court nomination. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, we talk about the philosophy of love. Also, we speak with the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the shooters in that tragedy out in Columbine. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with actress Deborah Jo Rupp from That 70s Show fame. She's appearing at the New Theater Restaurant, opening February 15th with Boeing. We'll talk about it in just a couple of minutes here. I read, Deborah, that you always wanted to be an actress, but your parents weren't wild about the idea.
Oh, dear God, no.
Why?
Oh, no. Because it was like a hobby to them. And I think, you know, I wasn't like, well, I was not as attractive as they thought possibly a successful actress would be.
Oh, come on.
No, I was a character actress. Mm-hmm. And I was a really late bloomer. I didn't come from money, and I didn't go to Yale. I went to college. I got a degree. They did start a theater department. My dad picked the best liberal arts school in the country at the time, mm-hmm. 1969.
And that was what?
That was University of Rochester,
okay.
To him.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't have a theater department. That was the one thing. And I was always a good girl. So I went, okay, I'll do it later.
Mm-hmm.
And then the year that I started, there was the moonwalk, and they started a theater department.
Boy, fortunate for you.
It was great.
And you just gravitated toward it?
I remember running into my father and going, oh my God, Dad, they started a theater department. And he turned white.
But his concern was what? That wouldn't provide you with a
living? He wanted a doctor.
He wanted
a
doctor.
It was Strong Hospital in New York. You know, uh-huh. They wanted a doctor. And I was kind of smart. You know, I got good grades. So it was like, no.
This wasn't going to fit.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
And so your goal as an actress back then, what did you want it to turn into for you? What did you want to be?
As an actress?
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to be huge. just huge. Mm-hmm. I like telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a storyteller. So that was fun for me, and it was. And sometimes when it's not fun and it's a drama, I like affecting people. You know, I like touching people, and I'm kind of a social person, so I wanted as much as I could get from it. You know.
Deborah Jo Rupp is my guest. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCUR up to date. When did you begin to get some serious work? When did you begin to think this was going somewhere?
1986. I was 36 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, I was really, really, really late. I had to work a full-time job. I was in New York City, but I had to work a full-time job, and I couldn't do summer theater like all my friends did, because I would lose my job.
Oh.
So I took 8 million acting classes just to keep going. I would audition in my lunch hours. I would just say, my mother taught me how to be a bookkeeper in like 15 minutes. Basically, you just take a piece of paper, you turn it over, and there's directions, and that's all you do.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of conned my way into that. And then I would just say, I'm going to the bank. And then I would go do 3 auditions in that period of time and come back and just say it was a really long line at the bank. And I started getting commercials. So that brought in extra money. And then my first big thing was a show that was nearly a one-woman show. And then And once I did that in New York, got a little notoriety, a little bit, it just kind of grew from there. I just needed one break.
Did you have your parents come see that?
Oh, yeah. No, they were that. Once I did that one, it was okay. And then I got Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Kathleen Turner on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Then they went, oh, well, maybe. She might have a future.
She's doing something here. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you have a moment where you thought you had made it?
Well, Broadway was kind of the furthest I thought I could go in New York. You know, I got to the tippy top, but I wasn't going to make enough money to buy a house because really theater doesn't pay a lot of money. Mm. So I thought, okay, I know, let's go to Los Angeles and see if we can make some money and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always the plan. And I am one of the very few people I know that at 40 decided to go to Los Angeles because, you know, actresses always work over the age of 40. But for some reason, maybe it was the hardship in New York. For me, you know, the just pounding on doors and pounding on doors, it just clicked. The minute I got to L.A., it just went boom, 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 boom.
Boy, it seems like you must have a whole lot of spunk, Deborah, because to be turned down that much, to be the age that you were, to keep trying and going after it, that takes someone.
I'm telling you, for young actor people out there, it was the acting classes that did it, and it was the teachers. It was the, oh my God, you're really good, you're really good, and that would keep me going for another month, and and eventually, it was an acting teacher of mine that got me my big break and fought for me.
The big break being?
Uh-huh. It was called A Girl's Guide to Chaos, and it was Cynthia Heimel wrote for The Village Voice, and she wrote this thing, and Terry Garr was supposed to do it,
but
Terry was busy, so I did the workshop of it. And my acting teacher was directing it, and then he just said, look, you've got to keep her, just keep her.
Wow.
And I got it.
But you get to L.A. Is that when you did your first film big in 88?
No, Tom Hanks? Did. I actually got big in New York.
In New York.
And this was, I don't know. It must have been after Girl's Guide to Chaos. I'm telling you, 1986 was the big thing. So it must have been late 80s that I did
big. Because this is a film that Tom Hanks starred in. You played Hanks' secretary. I mean, that must have been kind of cool.
It was cool, but it was but I would call my agent and say, I'm not doing film again ever again.
Because
there's so much waiting. It's not like theater. It's like once you start the show, you're on and you're moving. Film is like, you have to wait for the lights, and then you have to do it over and over and over again, and there's no audience. And I said, no, I hate this. I'm not doing film anymore.
It was just too chopped up for you.
I couldn't stand it. And then I was, I was stuck in this little office as a dressing room by myself. I just hated it.
Did you get to know Tom Hanks at all?
I mean, Oh, yeah.
And what did you take from that experience?
Well, Tom Hanks was a little hysterical because he thought this film was going to end his career. Nobody knew what this film was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And Elizabeth Perkins had just this huge pimple on her face, and so she didn't want any photographs. It was something. And I just thought, no, I just want to do theater. And my agent went, honey, listen, there's no money.
There's no money in theater.
You're going to have to bite the bullet and do the film.
Did you see greatness in Tom Hanks on the set of Big, or was that just something that just wasn't there yet?
I knew Tom Hanks from Bosom Buddy, and I loved him. And he's also really one of the nicest people on the face of the earth. And he would always remember me after that. You know, if I would see him, he would remember me. And then he cast me in the HBO series about the astronauts.
Oh, yeah.
So he's he's kind of loyal too. I just love him. I really love him.
I've always heard good things about that
guy.
Yeah,
no, he's a really, believe everything you hear that's good because he's a really good guy.
Yeah. Deborah Jo Rupp is my guest. She's starring in a new theater restaurant production of Boeing. Boeing, you know her from That 70s Show. You also played Lisa Kudrow's sister-in-law on Friends and then Jerry Seinfeld's agent on Seinfeld, obviously.
Yeah.
Those were two, you know, legendary TV series. How were those sets alike? How were they different? Was that fun? Not?
I know when a series is going to hit. And that's when there's not a bad egg in the bunch, you know, that they all like each other and they all respect each other. So
and that was the case.
That's totally the case for Friends and totally the case for Seinfeld.
No
tight
kidding.
Group of people and really respectful of each other and really hard workers, like wanting everything to be as funny as it possibly could be.
That's got to be a little unusual to have a cast, an ensemble that large, at least in the case of Friends, and have people that dedicated to it.
Well, and 70s Show was the same way. We worked hard to make those jokes work, you know.
And people don't see that. They just think you walk out there and it just flows and you're brilliant, you know.
Yeah, no. I have to say that it's, you know, not the hardest schedule in your eighth year because by then, you know who the characters are. And
but the days are still long, though, aren't they? You always read
not for sitcom. No.
Really?
Not for single cameras long. But we had four cameras. So single camera, they move that camera to each person. Four cameras, it's like everybody's got their camera. You do it twice, you're done.
Because you always read about the old Andy Griffith show. It was a single camera show, and they were there forever all the time.
Yeah.
And you're saying that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I came across 78 acting credits for you, and I'm wondering what you would say to this idea of what is the secret to being able to find consistent work like you have to earn the title of working actor and how you feel about that.
I don't know what you're asking me.
Well, that's just a lot of credits, and I'm wondering how much pride do you take in this notion that you made it, you survived?
I take a lot of pride in it.
Yeah,
I
was going
to
say.
And the 70s show gave me the opportunity to go back to do theater again because that's what I love. That's my thing.
It gave you the opportunity because then you had a name.
I had enough money to live on,
mm-hmm.
and I could buy a home. So the two things coming out of 70s show, because I was so poor for so long, I came out going, you are going to own your car and you are going to own your home. So no one can take either one away from you. You're just going to own it. And I worked really hard to make that happen. When I was doing Broadway, I was still working my full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
I was still doing that bookkeeping because I was terrified that I wouldn't be able to pay my rent once the show closed.
Mm-hmm.
Security is apparently very important to me. And that's why I went into acting.
But clearly, you were meant to be. That's what where you
well,
were.
Well, and then you have to take the big step. Then you have to go, okay, all right, I'm going to take the big step. I'm going to borrow everything I can from the credit union, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to see what happens. And it worked out.
Huh. You were also in what I'm told is a cult classic, Death Becomes Her. As a psychiatric patient, you've done, if I have it right, Deborah, you've done comedies, drama, horror. Is there a genre you haven't done, and is there one you'd like to do, like maybe a Western?
I've done a Western. I did Briscoe County. Briscoe County was a Western, and I was in a stagecoach with... oh, God, the psychedelic drug guy.
Mm-hmm.
Leary? What? I don't know. Anyway, so I've done a Western. The one thing that I have not done that I can recall is science fiction. And I'm not a big science fiction person. Like, I didn't the Star Trek things. I would go to the auditions and go, I can't, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't, I'm the same way.
Yeah.
How did you get the part of Dr. Ruth in that one-woman production of Becoming Dr. Ruth? I'm going to play something here.
Do you want to play it now?
Well, go ahead and tell us how
you
got
it. Okay, so the writer of the play sort of knew me a little bit and called me and said, I'm doing this one. I'm going to write this one-woman show, and I want to write it for you, and it's going to be Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And I said, the little sex woman? No. I said, no, I'm not your girl. I can't, not the sex woman. And then he goes, well, did you know that she was a sniper in the Israeli army? And I went, well, then I'm so your girl. I'm totally your girl for that. So,
why not the sex thing, but the sniper thing?
The sex thing, it was like, I don't really want to talk about sex for 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find, and also I didn't want to make fun of someone, because that's what I thought it would be, kind of making, you know, parodying somebody. I didn't want to do that. So when I found out about her life, her actual life, which is what it was about, it was fascinating. And she's a really good friend of mine now.
Oh, really?
I had dinner with her like a month ago.
She's still alive?
Yeah.
She must be.
Oh, my God. She was at every show.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Was she really?
Yes. Every show.
Well, let's listen to Deborah Jo Rupp playing a little bit of Becoming Dr. Ruth.
Dr. Wu's Guide to Teens and Sex Today. This is not an easy decision, deciding when to have sex for the first time. There are so many pressures from movies, from friends, from our own bodies. If you have a pot of boiling water and you try to hold that lid down, if you let go for even a second, that lid is going to burst off because of the pressure. On the kibbutz, my top popped.
That's pretty good.
Thank you. It got better. That's from an early production, I can tell. But it got better. That was a really, really hard accent, because it's Israeli, it's French, and
yes,
it's German.
I can hear that. Yeah.
It was really hard.
Let me just ask you about Boeing at the New Theater. How did the New Theater restaurant find you? They've been after you for a while, or?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know if it's been a while, but I know that my agents have worked with them before, and they called and they said, I like Boeing a lot. I've always liked the show, and I've never had a chance to do it.
And the show is, just tell us in a quick synopsis of it.
It's a French farce, although, well, yeah, it's set in Paris, but no one speaks French or anything, so don't worry about that. and it's three airline stewardesses that are paramours of one of the lead guys, and they just sort of come and go, and
the guy tries to keep
things
them separate
go wrong,
from each other,
and
things go wrong.
Yeah.
And you play a housekeeper for this.
I play
this
a
guy.
Housekeeper. Very different from Kitty, but so fun to do. I mean, so fun to do. And this show, can you say hell on the radio?
Yes, you can.
Okay. Goes like a bat out of hell. I mean, from the minute it starts, it's just like boom, 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 boom. And Dennis, the director, is killing us. It's like no pausing, no pausing, no pausing, no pausing.
Why? Because?
Because it's the rhythm of the show, I guess. I mean, I'm not directing it. It's the rhythm of the show, I think. And it's farce is run, 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 slamming doors, slamming doors, slamming doors. That's what farce is to me.
And you got to do this production. I know you guys work out there. You do 6-7 productions a week,
we
right?
We do 8.
8. Who's counting? 8. That's.
But you know what? It's.
Can you do that?
You can do that. I did 8 for Dr. Ruth, and that was just me alone.
Oh,
you can
man.
Do it, but you don't really have a life. The only good thing, you don't. You really don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like. You can't go out to dinner before a show because
yeah.
you just can't.
You can't.
And you can't go after the show because it's too late. So it's like you have no life. But when you're doing a comedy, you get so much from the audience, and you're so high when the show is over. You know,
keeps you going.
Yeah, and it's fun.
Boeing runs at the New Theater Restaurant beginning February 15th. It runs through April 23rd. NewTheater.com for more information and tickets. And Deborah Jo Rupp, what a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Good luck in your run, okay?
Thank you very much. Please come. Please come.
Sounds good.
It'll be fun.
Last year saw the Nevada sports books taking $133 million on the 2016 Super Bowl, setting a new record. It's a matter of odds, point spreads, and knowing who's the better team. We have some help here this morning to review the strengths and weaknesses of the teams and to explain how the betting works. Joe Posnanski is my former cohort from the Kansas City Star before he went on to write for Sports Illustrated. These days, he's the national columnist for NBC Sports. And Joe, good morning. You there, Joe? Hi, Joe. You there? Hello. Hey, Joe. We'll get Joe here in a moment. Professor Jeremy Martin is Director of Graduate Admissions for the Department of Mathematics at the University of Kansas. He joins us from the studios of KPR. And Jeremy, good morning. I'm not having anybody. Anybody there?
I'm here, Steve.
Who, Jeremy, you there?
This is Jeremy. Hi,
okay,
I'm here,
well,
yeah.
I'm glad somebody's there. I need to have somebody there to talk to. That's
and
great.
I hope Joe comes because I'm a huge fan of his work. This is a real honor.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you joining us. And
let me
start with you, Jeremy. Obviously, when I checked the odds yesterday, the Patriots were listed as 5-4, which means what in terms of a winning bet there?
Well, what it means is that if you bet on the Patriots, then you're risking $5 to gain 4. So if you place a bet for, say, $50, it means that if the Patriots win, then you collect only $40. If they lose, you pay out $50.
Well, why would you do that?
Win, then you don't care what the odds are because you'll make money if they win, if your bet is right.
But you're saying if you pick the Patriots and you bet on them and you win, you're going to lose money.
No, you stand to lose more than you might win if they lose. But
you're losing me. Say it again. Yeah.
You bet. Any bet you place, if your bet wins, you win money.
Okay.
And if you lose, you lose money. But in this case, the odds are 5-4. That means that if you win, you will collect less money than you would lose if your bet loses.
I see. So
you either win $4 or lose $5.
So what's the house counting on here exactly?
Well, this is really interesting because that 5-4 odds, it doesn't mean that the house thinks the Patriots are going to win. It means the house thinks that people will bet more money on the Patriots. So the house, of course, collects a commission. It's called a vigorish is the technical term for it.
Right.
Among bettors. It's a commission on each bet. I don't know. It's 10% or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But what the house wants is to have the same amount of money bet on both sides, on the Falcons and the Patriots. That way, as long as there's the same amount bet, they don't care who wins or who loses.
Mm-hmm.
They'll collect their commission and go home happy.
Oh, that's interesting. Joe Posnanski from Charlotte, North Carolina, joining us from there. Joe, always good to have you. Good morning.
Great to get you. I was yelling into the phone. It just wasn't working.
And it wasn't working. I could hear you. The audience simply couldn't. This is the wrong way to start this conversation, Joe, but I'm going to take a shot at it anyway. This game, this Super Bowl matchup, for some reason just isn't working for me. I mean, I admire Brady. I admire Matt Ryan. But there's a little something robotic or sterile or just plain uninteresting with these two teams, at least to me. Or am I getting old, Joe? Help me out here.
Well, I think seeing the Patriots back in the Super Bowl is a little bit of a fatigue factor throughout the whole country about that. I mean, we've We've told this Tom Brady story. We've told this Bill Belichick story.
Yeah.
So I think from that perspective, yeah, there's no question that it feels a little bit tired. Falcons are kind of cool, though.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the Falcons
that.
Are an interesting story, and I think Matt Ryan is very interesting. I think this is a little bit fresh, and their offense is really, really fun to watch. So I'm excited for that half of it and not as excited for the Patriots half.
So you're ginned up about the Falcons. Anything else have you excited about this game?
Well, I think it's going to be really high scoring. I mean, I think we're going to see a lot of points. It doesn't feel like either defense is really going to be able to stop the other. I don't know that. That's obviously a guess. I heard you talking a little bit. Obviously, people are going to be betting on how many points are going to be scored in the game. But it sure feels like one of those games that could just be kind of a wide open, fun, lots and lots of points game, and I think that's good. I mean, that's what I want from a Super Bowl. I don't particularly care who wins. Neither of those teams obviously are the Chiefs, so it's not really that relevant. But I'd love it to be a fun game and a good game, and you know, to me, a high-scoring game would be a lot of fun to watch.
Jeremy, talk to us about the over-under, which is getting to what Joe's talking about here, how many points might be scored, and what is that, and how does it work?
So the over-under is, I have to remember this. You're betting on how many points will be scored. And,
right.
And again, Vegas is going to set that number so that they have the same number of dollars bet on over as opposed to under. Probably it's pretty high for this game, I would guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two good offenses.
And I think this point is so missed by everybody, and I heard you say that earlier. All the odds makers are trying to do is get that middle point where they are getting as many people betting on both sides of the line.
Exactly.
That's all they want. They don't care who wins. They don't care how many points are scored.
That's
they
right.
just want to absolutely nail the middle point where half people are voting the over, which I think for this game, I don't even know what it is. It might be 60-something points
right.
or whatever, or the under.
And, Jeremy, they want in a perfect world, there would be – $20 million bet on one side of the over-under, $20 million bet on the other. And that's because why, Jeremy?
Well, Vegas is trying to minimize their risk because that way, if in your scenario, that means that they will pay out $20 million to the winning side and take $20 million from the losing side. And they don't care which is which, like Joe said. But in addition to that $20 million, they're getting a commission of, I don't know what it is, maybe 10%. I don't know what the standard is per bet. So if that's the case, they'd be pulling in, $4 million, $2 million from each side in commissions and making a lot of money.
What determines where the odds are set? Tell us again about that, Jeremy.
That's a good question. I don't know how Vegas does this. They really are trying to predict, again, not what will happen in the game, but how bettors will place their bets. So what they do to accomplish that, I couldn't tell you. I'm not an odds maker, but they have some way of predicting, okay, we think that if we set the odds right here, then we'll get even amount of money on both sides. Mm-hmm. And you'll often see the odds change before the game because if between, let's say today, a lot of people bet on the Falcons, Vegas will adjust the odds to make betting on the Patriots more attractive to try to even that out again.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah.
Joe Posnanski, can you see the Chiefs in this game next year with their quarterback, Alex Smith? How do you size that up?
Well, I don't know. I mean, how do you size that up? Obviously, you look at a 50-year drought for the Chiefs in the Super Bowl, and it's, you know, it really comes down to the quarterback, doesn't it? I mean, the Chiefs have just never been able to quite develop their own superstar, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning type of quarterback, Matt Ryan, who's there this year. They've never been able to do it, and Alex Smith is certainly a very competent quarterback. He certainly has moments where he, where you really, really enjoy the way he plays. Is he good enough to get them there?
That's the question.
Get them? Yeah, it's a wide-open question.
Yeah, yeah. Jeremy, what do you make of all these different types of bets that are available for people who want to bet on the Super Bowl? I mean, you can bet on the score after each quarter. You can bet on who's going to win the coin toss. I mean, it's just a crazy array of bets out there.
It's kind of like being in a casino where You're surrounded by the flashing lights and the noises, and it's kind of sensory overload. I think that, you know, Vegas's goal, and I keep saying Vegas, but, you know, any given bookmaker's goal is to have high volume and to balance out the bets. And I think that, I mean, I was trying to look last night at all the kinds of bets you can place, and I got confused. I couldn't keep track of them. But I think that they're just offering more opportunities for people to make bets and collect their commissions.
Joe, do you ever make bets on some of these crazy things that are available out there?
I'm not really much of a bettor, but I have been in Vegas and have spoken with odds makers quite a bit about the Super Bowl. And, you know, these crazy bets you can make, who's going to score the first point, will it be right. A field goal or a safety or whatever, these are just to get people in the door. I mean, Vegas does not expect to make a lot of money or lose a lot of money because, you know, they keep it very, very limited. You can only bet so much money on those kinds of things. They're really trying to get everybody to come in and bet the game, and it's exactly what's been said. They're trying to get as many millions of dollars as they can get on both sides of that thing and then just cash in the nice 10% vig that they're pulling in. I mean, that's the whole idea. It's such big business and so much money changes hands, and obviously these fun side bets are just kind of part of the, you know, just to draw interest and get people in.
And Jeremy, the favorite now is the Patriots.
Mm-hmm.
By what? 2-3 points?
I honestly, I don't know. I haven't checked.
Yeah, by a
few I'm also
points.
Not a betting man.
Yeah, okay.
We have a saying in mathematics that a lottery is a tax on people who are bad at math. We tend not to buy lottery tickets or place bets in my area.
Joe, just real quickly here, the Royals just endured tragedy again. Yordano Ventura, the pitcher, what kind of impact will this have on the team this year?
Well, it's going to have a very, very big impact, I think, not just emotionally, which is obvious, and everybody's feeling the pain of you know, because he wasn't just that he was a terrific young pitcher. I mean, he was so full of life and so emotional. So that's going to be big. But frankly, I mean, on the field, it's going to be a big thing. I mean, he was obviously a mainstay on that staff. He was he's 25. He was really coming into his own. It's a terrible, terrible blow and a very, very sad day.
That's Joe Posnanski from NBC Sports, formerly of the Kansas City Star. Joe, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Professor Jeremy Martin, a director of graduate admissions for the Department of Mathematics over at KU. Jeremy, thank you very much, too.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks a lot.
Monday on the show, is love biological, cultural, a social construct? We talk with a philosopher who spent years studying it. We also speak with Sue Klebold, whose son Dylan was one of the shooters at Columbine. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Ron Yerman, Suzanne Hogan, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tadakoro. I'm Steve Kraske. Have a great weekend, all. And you are up to date.